Welcome to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, airing live on unceded Coast Salish territories. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only animal advocacy radio program, bringing you all you need to keep you up to date on what's happening locally and abroad, from interviews with amazing change makers around the world to news, events, and lifestyle. Animal Voices can be heard live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and can also be streamed at coopradio.org, or you can check out animalvoices.org for podcasts soon after airing. Today is Friday, April 24th, and that means it is World Day for Animals in Labs. Joining me in studio today, we have Darren.
Hello.
And Amir.
Hey.
Welcome, everyone. So since it is World Day for Animals in Labs, we will be talking about all the non-humans who suffer at the hands of scientists in laboratories every day. Progress for Science is a campaign primarily focused on ending vivisection at the University of California, Los Angeles. Their first objective is to end primate research at UCLA. The Progress has three goals: one, to educate the public; two, to hold researchers accountable for their actions; and three, demand that funding for these experiments stop. We speak with organizer Dr. Carol Glasser about this campaign and World Week for Animals in Labs. We also speak with political theorist Laura Gennara, who works through historical tasks of Western political thought, especially early modern and modern, and through contemporary critical social and political theory. Her work is historically grounded and attends to language and symbolism as terrains of politics, gender and other axes of identity-based power, and the constitution of subjectivity, non-human life and questions about non-human animals, plants and seeds against the backdrop of capitalism, democracy, and colonialism. She shares with us her wealth of knowledge about the failing ethics of animal research. And today is the last day of our spring member drive. What this means is we are encouraging our listeners to become members to help keep Animal Voices on the air. Animal Voices is entirely volunteer run, and we bring you, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we bring you news, events, interviews, and lifestyle commentary that you would not hear anywhere else likely. So, we're a really important show to keep on the air. We have a lot of voices that wouldn't get the opportunity to share these stories with you in other media.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like it's an important show, and I'm really proud to be a part of it. I joined Animal Voices about 2.5 years ago, I believe. And I've really appreciated the opportunity to have an outlet like this where I can share my thoughts on animal issues, as well as just, you know, get in touch with all these amazing people around the world.
For sure.
Darren, do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I'm actually technically not even an official member of the Animal Voices Collective yet, but just having been given opportunities to come here and, yeah, just, you know, listen in and see how radio is done, I think that's, you know, a unique opportunity in itself. And it's mm-hmm. all thanks to Co-op Radio for mm-hmm. people who are even interested in doing radio to have the opportunity to starting to get involved in various ways.
Totally.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's a big part of it is just the people that have that interest and have that these stories to tell. They can do it without having to, you know, pertain to commercial interests or be involved in that kind of a system. So it's a great radio station, and I hope that we'll have some members join us. Please give us a call if you want to get involved at 604-684-7561 to become a member. Darren, you had something to share about your experience in the lab.
Yeah, so I thought since it is the World Day for Lab Animals, I'd share some of my own personal experiences on working inside a laboratory. So about a year and a half ago, I had an opportunity while I was working as a research assistant at the UBC Animal Welfare Program to actually help a friend of mine who was working on her PhD there, and she was studying the emotions and cognitions of rats. And basically, she was looking at rat behaviors and comparing the differences between rats who were given much better living environment versus, you know, just tiny cages that are typically housed in inside laboratories. And her goal is really, I guess, in short, to use these scientific methods so that she can prove scientifically to other scientists that rats are not only very social, very highly sensitive, intelligent beings But to present an argument to them that, you know, because of these facts that we should phase out and eventually abolish the use of rodents or, and other animals in scientific experimentation.
I was just going to ask, what did you learn about the rats doing these experiments?
Yeah, so besides learning just about, you know, how intelligent and social these animals are, and actually, you know, for the very first time in my life, being able to have interactions with them and kind of like seeing them up close, what I really learned was that one of the most important things for that this kind of study is relevant for us as animal advocates and animal activists is that we need to practice different forms of advocacy with different species of animals and in different situations and contexts. The way that we advocate for lab animals is going to be really different in how we can advocate for animals exploited for food, for example. Right. And I kind of saw that that what my colleagues did with these rats was sort of a way of working inside the laboratory on the front lines where these animals are being exploited violently and kind of using their results to show laboratory workers and people within that industry that, you know, there is a different way and we don't have to exploit these animals. And one of the examples is that they presented some of the results just showing the behavioral differences between rats in much bigger, highly enriched cages and environment, and just showing that and compared to, you know, rats in small cages. And they showed videos of rats, these rats, and at laboratory workers' conferences. And a lot of people were just shocked because they have never seen rats climb around in a cage or dig tunnels in soil or even just, you know, sleep together in a hammock. There's so many different things. And all this time, a lot of lab workers just simply thought, oh, that's impossible because these lab rats have been selectively bred for so many generations that they don't want to perform these behaviors anymore.
Yeah.
And now that they've seen that, you know, it's gotta make them think twice about what they're doing.
Yeah, because they kind of probably just thought of them as tools before rather than individuals.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that entire discipline, you know, using animals in science has so conditioned generations of scientists and to think that way, to basically indoctrinate them through, you know, formal education, to teach students from a young age that these animals are just tools and nothing more for us to use.
Yeah, I guess one of the challenges here, though, like there's a lot of science out there you can find now that says, you know, animal research really has no merit. But then somehow when you're talking to these opponents of it, they still find science out there that does maybe give them some room to say there is some merit to it. So, I mean, like how do we break down that barrier between the science that's for it and against it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely a difficult question. And I see that come up too, even within animal rights circles. Like I've spoken to vegans who are, you know, very much against animal exploitation. But when you bring up the issue of animal experimentation and science and, you know, development for cures and drugs, you know, even they have, you know, some uncertainties and dilemmas.
Right.
But we will be talking more about that later with Dr. Laura Gennaro, who has done a lot of research looking at how the various ways that, you know, that basically how our entire system of animal research from the ethics to the governance is just really inadequate.
Yeah, and I think it's also what you were mentioning too, how some vegans or animal rights people also are kind of like on the fence about the issue. I think a lot of it is because people, it's not really something that you can boycott. You can't boycott medicine if you need it to survive. And that's not really something that's going to achieve animal liberation for these animals anyway. It's action. And that's something that, you know, I've heard too from various people. They're like, well, what do I do if I'm dying? If you're dying and you need something that was experimented on an animal to survive, would you take it? And I think that's something that it's not really even relevant to this conversation necessarily, because it's not a boycotted type of a activism route, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's definitely a lot less about boycott and a lot more about changing an entire culture that is oppressive to animals in the long run. This culture that basically reproduces this idea that humans are, you know, just, you know, the only rational beings, and we can do with animals, you know, however we want.
Yeah. And challenging that system too, that, you know, keeps the animals repressed. Yeah. And I also thought there was some relevant news to this discussion. Not about rats, but two chimpanzees were recognized as legal persons, apparently, in New York. And Darren, you had something to share on this too, that maybe it's not as good of news as we thought it was.
Yeah, so the last that I checked, there has been an update on one of the articles. This is from Salon, and they said the court order has actually been amended to strike out the words, quote, writ of habeas corpus, end quote, altogether. So this change, what they say is that this change indicates that no decision has actually been made regarding the rights or fate of the two chimps, Hercules and Leo, and that the laboratory that's holding them in captivity will also get a say in court to make a case for why they think they should be allowed to keep these chimps. So it's still very much an ongoing battle. But I think just the fact that it garners so much media attention around this issue for the past week or so, it's still better than nothing.
Yeah, I think it's at least making people kind of question the idea that, you know, maybe chimps are legal persons. Why do we think they're not? And it's, you know, it's kind of stirring up that conversation in the general public that wouldn't even be there otherwise. So
yeah, definitely.
All right. And so Darren and I tomorrow will be going to join the University of Washington, the demonstration against the University of Washington, which is taking place tomorrow. It's a march on UW, and it's to protest the building of a new animal laboratory.
Yes, and this is an ongoing campaign that has been organized by the campaign named No New Animal Lab, which I think originated in around just the Pacific Northwest and Portland more specifically. I think the main organizers are from Portland, and there's been an interview with them on the show.
Yeah, there was. There's one back in the summer, I believe, when it was just kind of starting. So yeah, check that out. Search No New Animal Lab on our page. Yeah, so the campaign, like Darren mentioned, has been going strong for months, including protests at head offices and homes of Skanska executives, university officials. There was even a tree sit not too long ago. Yeah. And there's been lots of actions going on. So it's a great campaign to support. This march will be hundreds of people. I believe someone from Shack 7 will be there to speak, which is going to be exciting.
Laura and Gazzola.
Perfect. Yes, that's right. I was like, I forgot the name, but yeah, that's exactly it. And so meeting will be at Red Square at the University of Washington in Seattle at 2 p.m. And that is tomorrow, Saturday, April 26th.
It's a perfect reason to come to Seattle, you know, exactly. Road trip to Seattle. Yeah.
Exactly. Support activism and not just buying consumer goods, but you can also do that too. Buy donuts like we did last time. So yeah, it's going to be a great day. And Sunday, the day after, there's also going to be a full day of home demos in Seattle. So a lot of people I know, from, the greater Vancouver area and from other areas of the US are going there for the whole weekend and kind of just getting involved in everything from start to scratch. I think there's even, today there was even a court hearing in relation to this. So yeah, it's quite a full weekend, but it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing up the court hearing. Actually, I think it's really important to bring up that the campaign No New Animal Lab is currently under attack from slap suits from both the University of Washington and Skanska. That's basically suing them for a variety of things. So any kind of legal and monetary support that you can give to this campaign is extremely helpful right now, because going to court costs a lot of money.
Definitely.
So check out No New Animal Labs on Facebook for more info. All right, and we have our first interview. Dr. Carol Glasser is a co-founder and co-organizer with the anti-vivisection group Progress for Science, which opposes all uses of non-human animals in experiments and is currently focused on ending experiments on non-human primates in the public university system. She's also an assistant professor of sociology at Minnesota State University. Her research examines social movements, critical animal studies, and gender inequality. Her work both in academia and in the streets is committed to creating a more egalitarian world. Carol joins us today to speak about the Progress for Science campaigns, current actions, and plans or activities for Animal Lab Week. Hi, Carol. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So what initially sparked in you the concern and outrage at the suffering that lab animals endure?
When I was in my mid-20s, I was in graduate school at the University of California at Irvine, and I began to become aware of different animal issues. And through that process, I became aware of things that were happening on my own campus. Specifically, research on cats was really compelling to me. So I began to learn a lot about what was going on. And being in graduate school and later becoming a professor, I became committed to stopping the abuses that were happening in the communities of which I was a part. And the more I learned about the lack of knowledge among the public about what is actually going on and the false belief that people have that these sorts of experiments are useful and actually leading to medical advancements, propelled me to really want to focus on this issue to sort of to definitely dispel this myth and to help these animals who are currently suffering in laboratories.
Okay, and can you tell, is that what kind of led to the evolution into Progress for Science campaigns?
Progress for Science was initially started with a collective of women. There were about seven of us who were starting, and we realized that there was really just, we were all in the Los Angeles area, and we realized there was just one serious thing that happened every year, which was during World Week for Animals and Laboratories, which is the week we're talking about now, and that was pretty much the only week anything happened. So we got together, and we got a brainstorming session together and decided we had to start something that was more serious and more regular, and we also wanted to really have some good, strong feminist organizing principles behind the work we did. So from that, Progress for Science started, and it evolved until there were several core members who continued and have kept Progress for Science running for about 2.5 years now.
Hey, Carol, Amir here. Sort of a bigger sort of general question regarding what you do. There seems to be, like, science is a huge umbrella, and there seems to be within science, animal research, two sides to it. So there's a side of science that says, you know, there's really no merit to this scientifically, but then there are certain people on the other side of the debate that do find avenues through science to say otherwise, that there is some merit to what they're doing. How do you break down this challenge? I wonder if you have any insight on that sort of challenge.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that the majority of the time, these research experiments are not necessary, and they're studying things that are pure curiosities that aren't actually important to study. I do think that there are cases, and I won't deny it, where animal research did lead to some advancements in science. However, we need to be aware that there were alternatives, and often available alternatives that might be more appropriate or that have higher effectiveness rates and higher rates of predictivity have not been used in lieu of using animal science, because animal science is, at its base, more profitable, because once you invest in new technology, it exists. When you have to continue to breed, to buy restraints for, and to buy tools to research on non-human animals, it keeps the cash flow coming. Right. And the university profits off of this, because for every grant that comes in, they take a cut, and it's dependent on the grant, but it's usually hovering around 50% of every grant dollar that comes in is going straight to the university.
Okay. Wow. And so, yeah, you just covered a lot, which is awesome. And that kind of leads into my next question, which is what were the initial goals of this campaign? What were you asking the university?
Progress for Science would like to see an end to all research on non-human primates. Because we were in the Los Angeles community, we wanted to see a change in our community. And many of us were, we had come out of the University of California system, which is one of the more egregious offenders in this case, and is doing some of the most frivolous research studies, which is addiction studies on non-human primates. So we feel like this is a bottom rung of a ladder that needs to be climbed. These are clearly frivolous studies. They're on an animal, a non-human animal, that most of us would agree should not needlessly suffer or be tortured for mere curiosity. So our initial goal of our campaign was to end addiction studies, which are publicly funded meaning they're paid for by tax dollars, on non-human primates. And we started our campaign at UCLA. We've expanded it to, we focus a lot on UCLA, but we would like to, we are demanding that the UC Regents immediately end all testing on non-human primates in the UC system and immediately reevaluate all of their animal testing policies. We would like all experimentation on animals to stop. And since that time, we've expanded our campaign to the University of Minnesota, as we have a number of dedicated activists who are currently in Minnesota, myself included.
Okay, great. And what are some of the memorable actions that you can tell us about that have you've been involved with in with Progress for Science?
I think that some of the more memorable actions have been some of the actions which maybe did not get as much notice. Some of the actions that we do are merely candlelight vigils in the neighborhoods of people who are currently experimenting on animals. And in some of those, people have really been able to talk about the animals who were trying to help. And in the course of the vigils, have been able to speak about how they're feeling. And I think it's been really meaningful to see our resolve as individuals who care about others really grow and strengthen as a community in something as simple as holding a vigil. And that has inspired a lot of strength among our activists. And that strength was really seen on January 18th, 2004, in a protest when animal researchers, vivisectors at the University of California, Los Angeles, came out while we were holding such a vigil and decided to berate us, harass us, and in a couple cases, physically assault us. It was a very stressful demonstration, but it really showed the true colors of the vivisectors, and the activists remained calm and in their resolve, and showed just how unwavering we're going to be. And the response of the community to this action and seeing video of these vivisectors really laying into and harassing and assaulting peaceful and quiet activists who were merely trying to pay tribute to the non-human animals who they were torturing was a wonderful response. And on February 15th, 2014, I can't remember the exact number, but somewhere between 40 and 50 activists showed up, and we had a beautiful demonstration and protest, and showed the Los Angeles community just how important this issue is, and we showed UCLA that we will not back down until they release these animals who are currently held in their labs. And if anyone's interested in those videos, we have a YouTube site. So on YouTube, if you just go to Progress for Science, you can find these videos.
Yeah, and I also actually posted the video you were describing on Animal Voices webpage, so people can check it out on our podcast page for today. Yeah, that also kind of leads into a question that I hadn't thought about until you mentioned that. Since you mentioned earlier that Progress for Science is kind of a feminist organized collective, and, you know, obviously getting berated like that can be quite threatening to a wide variety of people. What do you have a sort of kind of support system in place when these kind of things happen?
What do you mean by a support system?
Do activists come together and support each other in this kind of a situation, or moving forward, like after this, obviously that's stressful. How do you deal with that as a community?
That's a really good question, and I think organically we've just had a lot of support, and so we haven't had to come up with formal structures for it. Mm-hmm. So we regularly meet for meals before or after some of our more stressful or more fun demonstrations, whatever the case may be, so that we can just come together as a group and get ready to be unified and to debrief after. So we do them both before and after. In the Los Angeles area, Progress for Science is currently starting monthly prisoner support letter writing nights, which provides some time for us to come together, and also partners with a wonderful group called Art for Animals' Sake on some various fundraisers and some events. And so that gives a time to sort of spend time together in a way that's really meaningful and that's working towards social justice and the things that we care about, but that's maybe not out street and in protest. And in the Minneapolis area, we also regularly meet for meals before or after, We have a really great community here, and we come together and think about the different campaigns we have going on and sort of stack our protests so that we can go from an anti-vivisection protest to an anti-fur protest that someone else is organizing and come together for a meal in the middle to really build a sense of community where we can debrief and work through some of these things.
Great. And you kind of touched on this a bit earlier, but can you tell us a bit more about what some of the experiments going on at UCLA currently are, and I guess the University of Minnesota as well?
Yes. So David Jentz is one of the vivisectors at UCLA, and sometimes it's difficult to know what they're actively doing. We can know the grants that they currently have and the things that they're currently publishing. And so from that, we know, for example, in 2013, in addition to his regular experimentations on rats, mice, and non-human primates, he was injecting pregnant monkeys with BPA, only to conclude that BPA interrupts the healthy brain development of infants. So we felt that was a particularly egregious and needless study. Edith London is another person who we're very concerned about. And a grant that she recently got in 2013 of $400,000, and again, this is federal grant money, so this means taxpayers are paying for it, is to mentor graduate students. And so while this is not directly researching on non-human animals, we see from her publications, she's often second or third author on publications with graduate students. And so we're particularly concerned that she's mentoring graduate students to shy away from newer and more effective technologies and go into the animal model. In 2012, we're very concerned that UCLA hired a new animal vivisector who had actually currently been in a lot of trouble at UW-Madison when a monkey died during a research experiment where it was revealed that she used inappropriate tools to drill holes in the monkey's skulls and attach devices to them inappropriately. Much of her research includes this sort of image that we see on a lot of protest campaign materials coming out of animal rights anti-vivisection work where there's a device physically soldered into the head of animals, including non-human primates, and she's recently, as recently as 2013, published a study that suggests she's still doing this research at UCLA, where she is looking at memory and the rates at which monkeys blink by sending electric shocks to different parts of different neurons in the brain, and she's also currently working with the similar research on rats who are, I believe, already dead. She has a number of articles on that. I've only reviewed a couple of them so far. At the University of Minnesota, we're most concerned with the work of Marilyn Carroll, who also goes by Marilyn Santee. She's a professor in the Department of Psychiatry, and she also teaches or is an adjunct in the Department of Neuroscience. And she's received a lot of money and been at this kind of research for over a quarter century, and she forcibly addicts rhesus monkeys, rats, and mice to drugs such as cocaine, heroin, nicotine, and alcohol, and she does this often by withholding food and water from them if they don't self-administer the drugs. So we find this work particularly egregious. She has a few really big grants right now. One of them is looking at sex and hormonal influences on drug abuse relapse, and she's using non-human primate models for that study.
Wow, that's a lot of information. That sounds awful. Can we agree? Yeah, it's really horrible. What has been the impact of your actions so far, either personally or politically?
I think in terms of our final goal, I think we're having an effect. You know, one of the things that we know that we're doing, though we don't have any way to concretely measure it, is we're opening the eyes of graduate students who would otherwise go into this line of research and showing them that the community does care and people are watching, and that with the amount of privilege they're going to get when they receive a PhD, that they can go into another kind of research. They can study the same things using non-human models, as is the case with Edith London. She publishes some of the same research with non-animal models as she does with animal models. So she and herself is a case study in how you don't need to use the animal model. For me personally, this has all made me a stronger and braver person because I realize that I'm fighting for someone other than myself, and that no matter what gets in my way, that I'm willing to keep trudging forward and keep up my hope. And I've done this, and so have other activists in the Progress for Science campaign, even in the face of repression. So one of the things, one of the tactics that's been used by these vivisectors is to personally try to get restraining orders against us, to selectively pick some people who are at protests and drag them through the court system. Currently, there's one restraining order was dropped by Edith London when the judge made it clear that it was not an appropriate action, and we're currently working, we're in the middle of a case with an anti-slap suit to fight this on First Amendment rights. Recently, Marilyn Carroll decided to do the same thing and is in the process, we're in the process of fighting a restraining order essentially against protest, as well as fighting some attempts at bringing charges against us for very petty things during protests, like are we standing in the right spot or not. And so I have, and so has the Progress for Science campaign, faced legal repression, but that has paled in comparison to the amount of support we've received from activists and just from average people who learn about this issue. And seeing people learn about this issue and care has made this work really inspiring.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of what you mentioned with the slap suits, I think No New Animal Lab is facing some of that as well. It seems to be a trend. Was anything special planned by Progress for Science for World Week for Animals in Labs?
Yes. One of the campaigns that we have is we do demos against, and I'm sorry, I was not able to hear the beginning of the show. Did you talk at all about the Delta campaign, the France KLM campaign?
We did not.
Okay. Well, there is an international campaign against Air France KLM, which is the world's primary transporter of animals who are used in laboratory experiments, and the last major commercial companies willing to engage in this transport on commercial flights. And Delta is their main strategic partner in the United States. So one of the things that Progress for Science does in Minneapolis is lend our support to that campaign by protesting at the airport. And in Los Angeles, Progress for Science works with a group called MC Cages LA, which is also doing great work on this campaign. So both in Minneapolis, at the Minneapolis airport at 11 a.m. Central Time, and then in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles airport at 1:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there will be demos at the airports against Delta. And then in Los Angeles, after that, they will do neighborhood outreach in the community of a UCLA vivisector, and they will be having one of those wonderful meetings I told you about to gather for food beforehand for anyone who's interested. And after that, they will support the No New Animal Lab march from Los Angeles with an action against Skanska, and the details of that will be announced at the previous demonstration. And if anyone's interested in finding out more about those, they can visit the Progress for Science Facebook page at facebook.com/progressforscience, all is one word.
Perfect. And just that kind of leads into the next question as well. How can people, both locally and abroad, help with your campaign?
Locally, if you're in the Minneapolis area, or in southern Minnesota, or if you're in Los Angeles, it would be great to go to our Facebook page and see the events that we're doing, visit our website, progressforscience.com, send us an email at progressforscience@gmail.com, and we'll get you on a mailing list, and we'll be sure that you know about events that are coming up. But you don't have to be local to help us. We work to make sure that we have regular events that can be done from your home, from your computer, or from your phone. So call-in, email events. We have some photo campaigns. And if anyone has special skills that they'd like to volunteer with us, we've had some wonderful volunteers help us do graphics and just give us great advice and organizing tips. But mostly the thing that everyone can do is just get active about this topic. Mm-hmm. Some of the best animal campaigns that I'm seeing in North America now are anti-vivisection campaigns. So anything anyone can do to support these campaigns is a wonderful and beautiful thing, and we want you to get active. So find a group that you believe in, that you support, and step out into the public square and do something for non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. Or start your own.
Yes, if there's nothing where you are, do start your own. And Progress for Science, and I know a lot of the other anti-vivisection groups that are currently doing work would be very happy to share our organizing models or any advice we have to help you get started.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Glasser. That was a wonderful interview. So that was Carol Glasser with Progress for Science. To find out more about them and their campaigns, check out progressforscience.com. In. Bring the money in. We won't have no dough to spend until you bring that money in.
Co-op Radio's Spring Member Drive is April 10th to 24th. Join us for special programming featuring the best that Co-op Radio has to offer. In-depth interviews, alternative music, local arts and culture. Call in to become a member or renew your membership and join one of Canada's first and longest-running community radio stations. In fact, we are 40 years old this year. Call 604-684-8494 or go to www.cooperadio.org to donate. Join us.
Put a nickel in the pot, boy.
It's true, I've found.
Put a dime in the pot,
but
boy.
But this money is for a real good cause. So
cents.
Everybody stick around.
Not on a quarter.
Bring the money in. Bring the money in. We won't have no dough to spend until you bring that money in.
You are listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 CFRO Vancouver, cooperative radio on unceded Coast Salish territories. As Jackie and Darren have touched on earlier, today is our last day of our member drive here at Community Co-op Radio. However, it is not the last day that you can donate and help keep us on the air. Why should you donate, you ask? Well, for one, Community Co-op Radio and Animal Voices give voices to people that other radio stations would not even consider. You think if I went over to Virgin 94.5 and wanted to talk about, let's say, for example, the cruelty that the baby seals are facing, that they would give me the time of day? No, they'd probably drown me out with Taylor Swift music. But I would shake it off and realize that there is a home for empowered speakers, empowered messages, and empowered movements here at Community Co-op Radio. To donate and become a member, you can pay as low as $5 a month, I think even lower if you really wanted to. And you can do this by going to cooperadio.org, or by calling directly to the station at 604-684-8494 or 604-684-7561. Remember to submit your donation on behalf of us at Animal Voices so the station knows how much you support and value our show. We not only value your coffee money, but we value your feedback and your opinions as well. And that's really all it is, coffee money. I know for myself, I spend a solid $4.80 on a coffee and a muffin at least once a week. Just today, I spent $8 on a coffee and a cookie. But enough about me. Give up a coffee and give back to Community Co-op Radio and keep your favorite programming on the air commercial-free all the time. So remember, either cooperadio.org or call us at 604-684-8494. We aren't doing this for us. Again, we're doing it for the animals and for those of you willing to be inspired. Donate today. And guys, I have to make this call again, so give me a sec.
Thanks, Amir. That was great. Yeah, so donate. Call now. Or you can also go to the website and donate directly. Just make sure, like Amir mentioned, to recognize that it is for Animal Voices. And and keep us on the air. We have so many more great people to talk to that maybe aren't even involved in animal liberation yet. So, you know, we want to stay on. I think Animal Voices has been on the air for around 10 years. I might be a bit short on that, but keep us on longer.
Great. Yep. So up next, we have an interview with Dr. Laura Genera, who is a political theorist at the University of British Columbia, whose research in the past couple of years have looked critically at post-secondary research institutions that use animals. So to give more of a context, according to the Canadian Council on Animal Care, an oversight organization that is supposed to govern the use of animals in science, millions of animals are exploited and killed at Canadian universities for the purpose of research and education each year. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so in your research, you looked critically at three institutions, the University of Canada's National Funding Agencies and the Canadian Council on Animal Care. Each of these institutions play a major role in reinforcing and sustaining animal exploitation at universities. Could you first describe the relationship between them? For example, what their roles are and how they work together?
Sure, yeah. So the funding agencies, the federal government is structuring university relations with animals. And one way that it does this is, in fact, through the funding agencies or funding councils, which give money to scholars in Canada to do things. And two of these agencies, they give money to scientists in particular in Canada to do research on animals, and these two same agencies actually are also the funders of the main funders of the CCAC, which is worth thinking about. And then in turn, the CCAC emerged out of a process that unfolded over the past century in Canada. Over this past century, the scientific disciplines have developed practices and cultures and norms that have normalized sentient animals as sites for research and teaching and testing. And through the 20th century, the Canadian universities were growing and research was expanding and industry and was interested in this. And this all led to a situation in the 60s, in the 1960s, where a recommendation was made for a control program within each teaching and research institution in Canada to oversee the use of animals in experimentation. And the idea was that through this program, scientists would peer review each other to check each other, and they would be guided by principles in doing this that were set out by an advisory body. And the CCAC is that body. It was instituted in 1968, and it draws up guidelines and policies for animal use and breeding, housing, experimentation, levels of invasiveness. And then, again, in turn, the university, each university in Canada that uses animals in any way, it has within it an internal university committee that's connected to the CCAC. And that internal committee assesses research and teaching projects that are already funded by the funding agencies and that will use animals in some way. And this internal committee, the ACAC, sometimes it requires modifications to the planned research or teaching use. But it does not block funding. The projects, once they're funded, they almost always go ahead.
Yeah, and that seems like a very problematic process of how funding is granted. And part of your work actually talks about that, which is basically you identify the problematic ways in how funding is approved for animal experiments by the funding agencies. Could you explain the ways in which this process is problematic? So, for example, what's wrong with justifying funding based on so-called scientific merit, and what's inadequate with the peer review process among scientific experts?
Right. So, the first question that gets asked in Canada about science projects that are proposed is, should it be funded? Not is it ethical, not is it necessary, not is it socially valuable, but rather, should it be funded? And that decision is based on the question of, does it meet scientific merit norms? And what that means is, does the project fit into the existing norms, the existing practices and interests and perspectives of the existing scientific disciplines in medicine, biology, zoology, and so forth? So what I suggest is that within the scientific disciplines, there are standing habits and ways of thinking about the use of animals that have come out of the last, especially century of history in science. And these standing ways of thinking in the sciences, they're reinforced as funding review reiterates these disciplinary norms regarding scientific merit. And so when the funding agencies assess projects, when they ask whether these projects should be funded, it's committees of peers, of fellow scientists who do this work of assessing. So that's what we call peer review. So what this means is that the funding reviewers are peers who are from a shared science culture. They're not a committee of, say, citizens who would ask about the public value of the projects or how necessary they are, how ethical they are. They're not committees of ethicists who assess the ethics of the projects. Rather, it's fellow scientists who say, does this meet norms of scientific merit? And then there's a whole other layer of real problem to this in that it's very difficult for these peers to judge proposed research well. And that's because every year hundreds of thousands of new science studies come out in science journals. And so the potential for duplication of science studies is incredibly vast. But Canada's funding agencies do not require any kind of systematic review of all this research that already exists. They don't require systematic compilation of all those studies and databases and registries of this existing already completed scientific work to help peer reviewers actually know what research is out there and how a proposed project stacks up against that. So the funding agencies may very well approve funding for projects that have already been done or whose value is dismissed by existing studies. So peer reviewers and researchers themselves, they lack systematic means by which to determine whether a project is new or to judge it carefully in the context of other research, and animals pay a price for this. One scholar, Frank Westheimer, who's a chemist, he encapsulates this problem in the following statement that he made, which is, a month in the laboratory can often save an hour in the library.
Yes. It definitely appears that there are many problems in the ways in which funding is granted for scientific experiments using animals. Mm-hmm. Shifting the focus now to away from the funding agencies and to the Canadian Council on Animal Care, one of the major focuses of the research was the language that the CCAC uses to not only justify animal experimentation as a so-called necessity, but to also present the CCAC itself as politically legitimate by being, quote, accountable to the public. You argue that the CCAC plays what you call a language game that is seriously misleading to the general public. What are some notable examples of this language game that the CCAC plays?
Yeah, this issue really, there's so much going on here that deserves attention. I'll just speak briefly about it. The key to public life in a democracy is the giving of public reasons. So every public actor has to give reasons to the public to justify their actions to the public, to convince the public of the legitimacy of what they're doing. And in a democracy, those reasons are required and also open to challenge. The CCAC, as a public actor, it gives reasons to the public to justify itself and thus to justify its own sanctioning of the scientific use of animals that it oversees. There's a few public reasons that the CCAC gives that I'll mention today. First of all, the CCAC says that it serves human interests. That's part of its mandate. That's interesting, first of all, because they don't cite animal interests as a guiding concern. But also human interests, you know, what does that mean? Human interests may be shallow, they might be short-sighted, narrowly self-interested. They may pertain to specific institutions or groups. They might be economic in nature. So what I'm saying is that the serving of human interests is not necessarily morally good at all. Necessity is another word that's used very intensively in animal experimentation discourse, and the CCAC does use that word, but it does not and it cannot claim that it sanctions only subjections of animals that are necessary to humanity or even necessary to just some humans. Rather, its bar is much lower than this. Its bar is whether the subjection of an animal is necessary to a funded program of research, teaching, and testing as imagined by some scholars, and that it meets norms of scientific merit. So necessity to humanity, no one uses that as a criterion in Canada for evaluation of animal use. And in fact, the larger proportion by far of animal use in science in Canada is not directed towards specific human plight. It's for not just sort of basic knowledge acquisition that interests the scientific disciplines and that they reward professionally. And then, Darren, you mentioned also the language of the CCAC being accountable to the general public, and that is a phrase that my analysis shows to be deeply misleading. It suggests that the regime has democratic foundations and constant democratic points of contact with the public. But that's not really true from what I show in my analysis. There's certainly been no past democratic deliberation about what constitutes ethical relations between the university and animals. And the claims that the CCAC makes to having community and public representation on some of its committees, they just really don't hold up under scrutiny. There are no clear democratic publics that are being clearly represented. And in fact, the CCAC regime is dominated by the science culture, not by democratic voices. And simultaneously, this is a very secretive enterprise. The CCAC and the universities, they withhold most information that they have about the university relations with animals from the democratic public.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have time to also mention the benefits to humans outweighing costs to animals?
I think we're at about 5 minutes, so I still got a couple more questions.
Okay, so. Okay, let's go on.
Okay.
Like I said, there's a lot to say about language.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, the language that they use is just so complex and misleading and manipulative. But and given that, the CCAC also promotes a principle known as the three R's, replacement, reduction, and refinement. Why isn't this principle effective when confronted with the realities of animal experimentation at various stages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, at the funding stage, which is the first stage, which enables projects to go ahead, there's no consideration at all of the three R's. The fact that researchers get money to do things with animals before the three R's is invoked already undercuts the goal of replacement. There's no real pressure on scientists to conceive of their research in ways that don't involve animal subjection. And the funding councils and the CCAC don't drive development of non-animal-based research and teaching methods. Then at the university level, the ACC, that's who's supposed to apply the three R's. They may ask for fewer animals to be used in a project, for example. But if they ask a scholar to reduce the numbers of animals, the scholar then saves money and can redirect that money to other animal-using projects. So from the animal standpoint, nothing has changed. The ACC is also supposed to encourage refinement of planned techniques in their use of animals, but the ACC and CCAC are using in this, they use a code of five types of invasion to encourage refinement, but they're actually just sanctioning those five types of invasion. They may make some projects less invasive, but at the same time, they're actually depoliticizing those kinds of invasion by just having this code of five types of invasion as being legitimate. Perhaps one of the greatest problems is that there are many fields in science. There's such diverse and specified expertise. It's really hard to imagine how an ACC committee can know enough to assess and critique each project that it oversees. And all they're working from is a 500-word description of the experimental design. That's all that the ACC knows. And in fact, a study of four Canadian universities showed that there are significant problems with ACC committee member understanding of the three R's. For example, some members of ACC think that the three R's are applied at the funding level, but they're not. So there are wrong understandings afoot, and many members also report feeling unable to judge and evaluate projects of other scientists. And in fact, what we see in Canada is that the overall use of animals is going up. It's not being reduced. Planned harm in specific projects may be reduced, but overall, the use is going up.
Yes. Your research makes clear that there is a lot of problems between the universities, the funding agencies, and the governing bodies. So how do you see this kind of work situated in the bigger picture of animal advocacy? So, for example, what kind of impact do you hope to make at the university, both within your own discipline of political science and also across disciplines? And also, how do you think this information would be helpful to the general public and to animal advocates?
Yeah. Again, so much to think about there. What I'll say today is that the political, the legal, and ethical position of animals in Canada is a problem partly because it's falling between the chasm that exists between the social sciences on one hand and the natural sciences on the other hand. people in the social scientists, scholars there, they work on ethics, politics, governance structures, power. However, they mostly, to date, are ignoring the governance of animals for no good reason, but they are. Meanwhile, animals are seen as belonging as a subject matter to the natural sciences. So scientists there get to represent animals and their interests, but they have no expertise in governing institutions and power and ethics and so forth. So we have this gap into which animals are falling, and I'm trying as a scholar to overcome this gap. And I'm suggesting that scholars of politics and governance and power, they need to start attending to political and legal governance of human-animal relations, because that's our job. A social scientist needn't even be an animal advocate per se to see the need for this work on the structures and institutions of our society. And then with respect to the general public, the method that I'm using for my work, I actually take it from James Tully, who's a scholar at the University of Victoria, a world-renowned political philosopher, and his method has a civic orientation to it. Scholars analyze a form of governance in which people are presently embedded, and the goal is to show how that form of governance arose historically through power relations, it didn't spontaneously fall from the heavens. And they are to provide a description of what the governance regime is doing actually in the present moment. What is its language game? What are the actual concrete practices of the regime and their effects? And this method, this analysis, enables you to get outside of the regime's own language game. And the result is to provide citizens with a critical distance from the familiar practices of the status quo, and to give them tools for new insight. So ultimately, this form of scholarship is designed to invite civic engagement, to help citizens actually see what their world is, see alternatives, the sort of power that's involved, and to gain analytical tools to think differently about it. So I see my research as a call to the general public, actually.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, Laura, and sharing those important critical thoughts.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
So you have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. You've been listening to me, Amir, Darren, and Jackie. Thanks for joining us today, Darren. Join us next Friday, where it's going to be more love in the name of animals for you all. I'm not really sure what the content of the show is going to be. If you want to connect with us online, you can go to animalvoices.org to stream our shows and read our blog. You can stay in touch with us via Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver. Send your suggestions in at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're closing today with a song called Off the Ground, Looking for Changes. Thank you so much for listening today. And remember to be kind to the animals.